Hello and welcome to the After Dinner Podcast. My name is Jay Swords. This is the podcast extension for ROI Show 552. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Gunter, Associate Professor and Chair of the Departments of History and Science, Medicine, and Society at Grinnell College. We're going to be talking about his book, Science and Civic Culture, The Politics of Knowledge in the Age of Improvement, 1720 to 1800. Our history buffs today are Rick Sweet and Terry Toppler. Terry, start us off.
All right, thank you. Yes, Mike, you mentioned that the Age of Improvement was a time of applying principles of reason to everyday life. And I noticed that it wasn't until around the 1730s that Parliament in England repealed laws against witchcraft. So my question is, could the Age of Improvement have been partly a consequence of entrenched old beliefs and superstitions among the people?
Okay, that's a really intriguing question. And it is one of the things I've always loved about the 18th century is that there's often a mixture of recognizably modern things that, you know, kind of looks like our world, and then elements that surprise us. So this example of, you know that it's the age of reason, and yet witchcraft, you know, doesn't get really end until the 1730s. I mean, there's other great examples of people whose personal experiences can either be interpreted and were interpreted either as demonic possession and witchcraft or as the new form of rebirth in the kind of Great Awakening, you know. And someone like Isaac Newton can in one moment be creating the laws of physics that looks like he's a modern scientist and then being doing alchemy and biblical chronology, you know, in the end time. So I do think, and I always try to remember that, and I am surprised at that. I don't want to project on them that they're entirely rationalizing modern figures who would, you know, sit right next to me and kind of share the same views. And so I think that's definitely worth thinking about. I think the tension, I think the Enlightenment idea of fighting prejudice and kind of superstition is important. And I didn't talk about that, you know, necessarily in our earlier conversations, but there is a sense in which this Enlightenment camp is trying to say, like, the old ways we did things were superstitious and they didn't have good reason behind them. And that's why we can improve so much. You know, cows die. Don't look to witchcraft as the explanation. Look to cowpox and look to modern techniques of, you know, of isolation of animals and new forms of kind of like smallpox vaccination and, you know, or inoculation, I should say. But anyway, so there's definitely that tension going. And one of the books that I often like to assign in my classes is Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, because Swift was on the other side of that. He found all these modernizing improvers really annoying, that they were always like looking down on tradition and common ways and stuff. And so he beautifully skewers them with all kind of satire that, you know, there's a famous scene in the book where they say, well, everyone builds the house from the ground up, but why? That's just superstition. Like, let's build from the top down. And of course you can't, you know, build a house from the roof down, but he, you know, I think exposes that tension. So I think that tension is really key to giving this group a sense of identity. But I need to think and sit a little bit more with this idea, or maybe you could tell me a little bit more about why you were thinking that, you know, witchcraft or these forms of tradition might have spurred improvement.
Well, sometimes it's a backlash. You know, when we've gone too far to left of center or right of center, there is a reckoning. You know, where we have a backlash and we try to come back to the middle. And so I was just curious if that was an example of that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I could definitely kind of see that at play. And even though I was just emphasizing the Enlightenment's camp's sense of, you know, that they were changing society and that they were against the forces of superstition, I also mentioned they aren't as divisive as it is in France, you know, with its anti-clericism and stuff. And one of the things that science and these groups tried to really do was to create a place where people would learn to get along if they had different views. So a lot of these clubs have fines if you say anything not nice about someone else, or if you talk about religion or politics in particular ways. Or there's just an effort in which these new spaces, libraries, coffee houses, clubs, try to, almost like in our current world, just realize that things can get off the rails quickly if you don't stay focused on a common goal. And so you have to be very careful to let people get to know each other and to develop kind of trust and working together. So, you know, so it's an interesting dance that they're playing. They kind of want to change the culture broadly, but they recognize that change can be divisive. And I like your image, though, of the pendulum swinging back and forth. I think that's definitely something part of the story. That's what I love about history, is thinking how to make sense of these, you know, how to build like an interpretation. Yeah.
Okay, Rick.
Yeah, I was going to let Mike know that in the capitalist industry I was in, when you said something bad about somebody in a staff meeting or a group meeting, you put a dollar in a jar. So that's alive and well still.
Yes, there you go.
Mike, I was going to ask, in your mind, in your research, what was the greatest scientific, technical, and or engineering application that came out of these 80 years that you studied?
Oh, that is a good question. And my students know that I get like a deer in the headlight sometimes when they ask questions. I don't know if it's a fear of commitment that makes me like hesitant to answer. Let me think about that for a second, because I do. Yeah, I think it's important. And I even sometimes think about what is the example I want to use when I talk to people, like around a kitchen table, of science being applied. So I think just at this current moment, you can make a case that the development of smallpox vaccination was a hugely important kind of moment in the history of medicine and public health, in terms of, you know, its long-term kind of trajectory, and it comes out of the 18th century in a way that people would be surprised of. But I also, I focus a lot on agricultural improvement. And in fact, the word improvement really takes off in the late 17th century around agriculture. And I think that, and being able to feed people and create the basis. So I guess one answer, like a clever answer, would be, I think, you know, inoculation of smallpox and some kind of techniques of public health and medicine and hospitals is one thing that really has a through line to the 20th century. But in terms of that moment in time, I think agricultural things would be, you know, probably the biggest. That, and I think forms of mapping. I'm giving you multiple ones, but I think the ability to survey and map is one of the great stories of the 18th century. You know, the development of the metric system, all these new trigonometric ways of surveying, you know, the U.S. is radically reshaped in the 19th century by the grid system, which comes out of this 18th century world. So I think agricultural reform, surveying techniques, and then kind of inoculation.
That's fair.
Mike, I'm going to sort of piggyback on that and go in a slightly different direction, because I think most of us in the modern world are pretty comfortable with the idea of science being revolutionary in terms of technology, the kinds of things that you were talking about. But I think you're also making an argument that science had a part to play in the age of revolution. And so that's the idea that science might spur some political revolutionary ideas or whatever, I think is maybe a little foreign. So can you talk a little bit about that, about how science did apply into politics?
Yeah, that was new to me as well when I was looking around at dissertation topics. I knew I wanted to write on the 18th century, kind of the world of enlightenment, but I had other things I was going to pursue. But I was really struck by finding out this aspect of science in the 18th century, that it was very consciously, a lot of this is shaped in the way that as they would say, the new science emerges at the end of the 17th century in Britain through people like Newton and Hooke and Boyle. And they are scarred by the English Civil Wars. And they argue that, you know, even in discussion with Thomas Hobbes, but that what is needed for society is a way to use reason that doesn't tear people apart, that is kind of collaborative and moderate. And that we need to learn how to not be divisive and arguing, and that the new science is exactly the place where you learn those techniques. Because unlike the older scholastic education that taught you how to argue and cavil, and at the heart of the old medieval training was the disputation, like learning how to kind of ritually like combat of ideas, the new science was all about collaboration. We work together. Like here, we just we use experimental knowledge, and no one puts forward dogmatic theories. We just see where the evidence follows us. And wouldn't it be nice if people applied that in politics as well? So they really very vociferously, like in speeches, poems, and all the prefaces to their scientific texts, say that science teaches a new way, a new form of intellectual modesty and kind of civic cooperation. And that surprised me, because I don't think of that as an aspect of science, you know, growing up in the 20th century per se. The Republic of Science, that it is the model of how equal people can collaborate and create spaces where they work together. So that political messaging is a really important part of why it's attractive to people in the 18th century. And especially as I was mentioning, because there was so much political polarization and stagnation in Parliament and in the colonies. And then when political conflict erupts, it's why the scientific kind of clubs and communities and networks, I think, step forward and take an even more prominent role than you might imagine. And in that. So, yeah, I think is where kind of I'm a little bit, I don't want to say breaking new ground exactly, but yeah, this is not normally what people think about, even historians, when they think of 18th century science, about it being kind of a seedbed of political revolutionary change. But I've become convinced it is because of this culture and because it gave people the tools to mobilize. And then when I look at the figures in the 1790s, Joseph Priestley, Richard Price, Thomas Paine, you know, all of the, Mary Shelley, like all the kind of figures of radicalism in the Anglo-American world, and in the French world too, they all share this kind of bond of science. And so by the 1790s, John Adams is kind of having, you know, conniptions because he's so upset about the radical worlds of scientists. And that's why when George Logan goes on his mission, he's like, we need to pass an act that prevents this. And things like the Alien and Sedition Acts and other things that were trying to clamp down on clubs and French radical emigres. Like by the 1790s, it had become clear to everyone that science was like a kind of a subversive network that was underpinning revolutionary politics. And so my story ends kind of when there was a, you know, to use that pendulum metaphor, the pendulum swings back and people decide science has become too polarized. It is only of one party. And there's an attempt to professionalize it starting in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. No more civic goals, no more ideology of transforming society. Science should produce knowledge in professional modes for itself and stuff like that. So it changes.
All right. I just wanted, I can't avoid an editorial comment. People who are historians are aware of sort of the revolutionary. John Adams had conniptions all the time.
Yes. Well, that's why he's so much fun to study. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
He's not a mild-mannered person.
He was losing his mind everywhere and almost everything. And So anyways, I wish we had like 4 hours to continue this conversation, but unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap things up. We would like to thank our guest for this 552nd show, Dr. Michael Günther, Associate Professor and Chair of the Departments of History and Science, Medicine, and Society at Grinnell College. We've been talking about his book, Science and Civic Culture, The Politics of Knowledge in the Age of Improvement, 1720 to 1800. The history buffs for today were Rick Sweet and Terry Toppler. ROI can be found at 9:30 p.m. Friday nights on KALA Radio or on the web at tunein.com. If you're looking for older programs, you'll find them at soundcloud.com. Just put KALA Radio, all one word, in the search, click on the first icon, and scroll down to find over a decade of ROI shows. You can also find ROI on all of your favorite streaming platforms. ROI is recorded at Station KALA, St. Ambrose University.